So the first question we have is, the only way to change culture is by changing people. Is this correct?
I don't believe so. I think it's a hand-in-hand process. Again, coming from the systems point of view, I do think that we respond to the systems that we're in, that we're part of. And if you can put an appropriate system together which acknowledges and understands how we are as humans, with all our fallibilities as well as all our good intentions as well, then I think that enables people to change too. But a really good example comes from the health sector. They're working at the moment, their terminology is to have a high reliability culture. And they're working at developing a strand of that, which is called a just culture. Because certainly within the US, that's quite a highly litigious environment. So often you will have health workers that are taken to court and sent to prison for mistakes they've made. And there have been examples where individuals within the healthcare system have brought to light an incident that anyone would have been, anyone would have done. You know, the same person with the same amount of training, the same experience, they weren't malicious mistakes. Would have made that same error because of the system, because the systems weren't supportive, the systems weren't appropriate, and the systems let them down. But because those people have come forward, because the individual has come forward and suffered as a result of coming forward and saying, look, I think there's been an issue here, it just means that other people won't come forward. They won't report incidents, they won't report near misses even. So when you're looking to develop a really robust, resilient organisation around risk, you want that information to be coming forward so you can put the right processes and systems in place to effectively deal with those. So that's quite an interesting area at the moment that's developing, the idea of a just culture.
We have another question. What are the common techniques for understanding and analysing the power relationships in an organisation?
Okay. This is an interesting one because not many organisations engage with trying to analyse and understand the power relationships in an organisation. But the approach that I've used previously, which can be very, very powerful in itself, is the idea of, again, coming from the systems field, is soft systems methodology. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, I've come across that before. But it's a reasonably involved process. But when you're talking about power relationships, often it does take time to understand, because we don't often see how those power dynamics are working. So it does take time to sort of uncover sometimes the layers and get down to those subconscious areas as to how relationships are affecting us in that way. And some of them can be very subliminal in how they're working. And often it's when you get people together and you get them talking, you get them building rich pictures, which is part of the process of soft systems methodology. And I think somebody made the point earlier on about being creative in your approaches of how you deal with it. Martin was talking previously. Being creative with this process really enables people to sort of outline these. And the other point I think is also worth making at this point too is the connection between enabling people to talk about opportunity at the same time as enabling people to talk about risk. Because studies have shown when people are talking about risk and focusing on risk, after a period of time, it kind of closes down. And because there's only a certain amount of time we can sit in that space talking about the things that might go wrong. But if at the same time we're enabling us to have a balance to that discussion, we can talk about opportunities alongside some of those risks, then we can often stay in that space a bit longer. It enables us to be a bit more creative with our thoughts and our ideas as to both sides of the equation. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, I think it does. This is a question I've actually had as well of my own. Why do we need to distinguish between organisational culture and risk culture? If you have good organisational culture, which would include risk awareness, shouldn't you have good risk culture?
I agree that that's where we're aiming for, absolutely, and that's the goal. But I think it's like anything. We can relate to this on a personal level as well. If you don't pay attention to something, it doesn't necessarily get moved forward or it doesn't progress at all. So whilst at the moment we are sort of talking and focusing on risk management culture, the ultimate aim will be that it becomes subsumed into the overall organisational culture and it becomes just part and parcel of how we think about our risk cultures. But we're not going to get there until the board actively, as part and parcel of their day-to-day activities, look at risk in what they're doing and reference risk appetite, reference their risk strategies, and see that as part of an everyday occurrence in terms of what they're doing. That's what I would say we're aiming towards for sure.
Do you know any examples of actions that were intended to enhance risk culture but failed miserably?
That's a very good question. I'll have a think on that. I might come back to that one, yeah.
Do you have any hints and tips on how to best engage an executive committee on risk culture when they may be part of the problem?
That's always an interesting one. And funnily enough, that has been something that's been part of the conversations I've been having this week with various organisations that I've been talking to. And that's interesting in itself. And that's a risk in itself within an organisation. Because whenever there's a kind of a barrier to communication, which clearly this is, then there's an issue there. So it's perseverance, it's persistence, it's language, it's often finding the right framework, because we will all look at elements of our work life and our environment through different mental models. And sometimes it's about understanding where they're coming from and what their perspective is. And again, I'd kind of take you back to the soft systems methodology, because that actually does look, and it's quite interesting, we're talking about stakeholders after this session, it is about eliciting the stakeholders' worldviews. And often once you elicit the stakeholders' worldviews, and your stakeholders are the executive board that might not necessarily be as engaged, then that enables you to frame what you're looking to do from a risk management point of view in a way that makes sense to them, that they can engage with. So I think that would be an approach I would use.
Is it fair to say that risk culture is a better indicator of how serious a company is on their enterprise risk management than, say, how good they are on their frameworks and committees and policies?
Of course I would say yes. But I think it's... The reason I think I would say yes is because I think it's harder to actually deal with, because, you know, the point that you made earlier on, it's not quite as tangible. And this has been reflective not just of risk culture, but of organisational culture full stop. If you look at when organisational culture first hit the theory and the literature, it was in the 1980s. And there's a wave of models and writing and research around organisational culture. And you had organisations talking about it and working with it. And then it's kind of gradually faded out of the picture, because you actually need to be reasonably confident about dealing with culture. And I think you need to look at risk culture. And again, another point that Joseph Healy made earlier on is, you know, if you can get people within your organisation having an experience of risk culture through their career, you know, the more you can get... individuals in an organisation understanding the concept of culture, what's involved with culture, what do we mean when we're talking about a power relationship and the dynamics of culture, what can you do as a fairly maybe junior level within the organisation but still in a leadership role, what can you do to give cultural communications, to be symbolic in the gestures, the documents, the language that you're using to convey these ideas of risk culture. So I would say yes. That's a short answer, yeah.
Okay. Can you link stronger risk culture to greater diversity, for example, gender, in risk management teams?
I think diversity, and we've done some work actually with strategic risk and the real key significance of having diversity within the board. And what was quite interesting when we presented that, and this is some work we did with the DTI over in the UK, amongst the oil and gas big companies over there, and we presented this work back to them, and you know, you're kind of facing a board with all male members to it, and you're kind of telling them that there's this idea, this diversity issue, and they're sort of not necessarily kind of taking that one on very easily. But I think diversity is going to give you a much more appropriate risk culture and a much more effective risk culture. I think, again, using the word strong and weak, I think I would just give a note of caution in the sense of a strong culture isn't always necessarily the right culture that you want, because strong cultures can mean that sometimes you've got a very inclusive group that it excludes other people, and sometimes the people it excludes are those other lines of defence that are in place to sort of help protect the organisation. So I would use the words appropriate and effective risk cultures rather than maybe strong or weak.
So I think that's all of our questions.
Okay.
So just if I could remind everyone to fill in their feedback forms. And we're now going to break for afternoon tea and come back at 4 o'clock.